This is the Context Podcast. Context Magazine is a publication of the American Sociological Association.
Welcome to the Context Podcast. Today we're talking with Professor Amy Finnegan of the University of Minnesota, Rochester, about her research in human rights work in Uganda, but especially her article, The White Girl's Burden, appearing in this month's issue of Context Magazine. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm wondering how much information we should provide to our loyal listeners about what Invisible Children is. I think most people have heard it the way that you've introduced your article, which is the Kony 2012 video from March of last year, which in a span of 72 hours, I think, was viewed by over 100 million people around the world. Everyone was talking about it for about a week, and then some things happened and some things changed.
Yeah.
Which we'll get to later. There was even a South Park episode referencing
the whole ordeal.
There was.
I should look for that.
But your experience with this group and with the issue, of course, goes back further. So Invisible Children starts in around 2004, 2005, right?
Yep, exactly. No, I think their first trip that the three young men who were the founders, I think that was in 2003. But their first film, Invisible Children, the rough cut, came out in 2005.
So it starts in their first trip to Uganda is in 2003. They make this film in 2004, I think you said. And filmmaking seems to be a big motivation and passion of the organization's founders.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I think that at least one of them had studied film in the university. And when I interviewed Jason Russell, I think that was probably his primary identity as an artist who enjoys making movies.
A lot of people, I heard both Africans and specifically Ugandans saying this, as well as a lot of American commentators and European commentators, that it seemed that while they were providing focus on Northern Uganda and Kony and the LRA and everything involved in that, the actual focus of the film seemed to be on them and their experiences. And if you look at some of the other videos they have for offer on YouTube or wherever you can find them on the internet, in more and more of them, it seems like the actual cause is not the most represented thing. It's not what you're looking at. You're looking at the activists and their story about coming to the decision to participate. Is that something you would agree with?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. And I think that they don't...
And do you agree that it's kind of weird? It's really what I want to know.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think especially because the advertised or the claimed frame is that this is about social change in Africa, when in reality it's a lot about young privileged people in the United States making meaning out of their lives. But at the same time, I do have to say that when I spoke to the leaders of Invisible Children and even in some of their films, I don't think they would deny that. Maybe a secondary or maybe an equally important outcome of their work. I mean, I think they feel they see what they're doing is creating something for young Americans to participate in. And I think that they won't deny that that's an objective of what they're doing. I mean, they're selling their fundraising objectives on sort of a saving the poor African child narrative.
Right.
I've gotten from them, for them being coming up front and saying that one of our major objectives here is to give privileged people in the United States meaning in their lives is not a savvy sort of message for fundraising. So I don't think that wouldn't be in line with their goals and with the success that they've had in fundraising.
Sure.
But I also think that they're pretty clear that, you know, they're trying to inspire people to be part of something and to do something meaningful.
This narrative that inspires your title, I think, and that repeats throughout the article, of saving these poor victims in Africa and the notion of Africa as a continent of victims seems to be pretty prevalent.
I think it is super prevalent. I think that we're in this moment, this cultural moment, which we've been in for a while, but I think it's been fueled by Hollywood in the last decade, been fueled by celebrities doing philanthropy in Hollywood. It's been fueled by this. I think it's been sort of the post Rwanda moment as well. Like I talked about that a little bit in the article. Like there's this moment now where inaction is the absolute worst outcome, and so we must take action at all costs. And I think that rides on sort of the history of Rwanda and the lack of international engagement there. But I think I'm steering from your question about Africa as a place of victims. I mean, I think that narrative is carried since colonial times. But I think there's right. it's in popular culture now in a really strong way, in movies, and particularly in the ways that celebrities have taken up issues in Africa.
I think the question that I and a lot of other people have, you know, being an academic, being into current events, knowing about what's going on in Africa, but having no actual connection to it, to what extent do, you know, people in Uganda have of that narrative? Is this something they're aware of? When they meet Westerners, do they think, you probably think of me this way? Or is it something that is, at this point, a narrative that's happening only with reflexive Westerners, I suppose,
yeah,
who are aware of it and trying to deal with it?
Yeah.
The sort of anthropology in the 90s question.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think that people are aware of it. I mean, my Ugandan friends, I think, are very much aware of it, particularly because of the internet in Uganda, you know, there's a huge international community presence, or there has been historically. And so I think people are savvy. They know sort of the narratives that work in Western circles and what sells in terms of getting funding. So I think that people are aware of it. I don't think that it's something that they buy into or that they try to replicate. Although in certain contexts, I think that it does get replicated, particularly in searching for funding. But I don't think that it's something people are aware of.
So that's a curious point. Does that create some tension between Ugandan organizations working to solve various social problems and the people that they're trying to help? And that they have to put, you know, they have one mouth that's buying into this Western narrative, at least for fundraising, knowing that this is the way that you get attention and you get resources, but also knowing that might be considered offensive. It might create the wrong impression of them for their own community. Is that something that happens?
I mean, people, my experience is that people are pragmatic, and they are, you know, interested in addressing the real needs in their communities. And so they will, not that they're going to sort of sell themselves out in order to get that, but they're going to be strategic in what they need to do to get the resources that they need. So an interesting kind of point on this topic that we're talking about is, part of my research in Uganda, which is not included in the article that I wrote, was spending a lot of time with young people in Uganda and activists and talking to them about their work, but also asking them to sort of reflect upon what was going on in the U.S. with invisible children. This was before Kony 2012. And
okay.
One thing that I was really struck with when I would show the films to people and sort of ask for their thoughts and feedback was their concerns, or at least this is generalizable here, but what a lot of people brought up to me as their concerns after watching the films was not necessarily the narrative of Africans or Ugandans being victims, primarily victims waiting for Western saviors, which was what my concern was as a white American coming to Uganda. But their concern was much more about the narrative of their story of the war not being comprehensive enough. And in particularly only telling sort of this bad guy LRA story and not telling the complexity of their history, which involves the Ugandan government in particular in atrocities and sort of in displacement and in real grave human rights atrocity or human rights violations. So I found it very interesting though, that this concern about that I have, or that I had as an outsider, of framing Africans as victims. It's not that people didn't see that, but that wasn't their number one issue. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, and this seems to also be an issue with both Invisible Children's earlier work and especially the Kony 2012 video, which is the kind of action, the kind of solution they're calling for seems to me to be really incongruous with the rest of their message. That is to say, you know, there's this subtle Christian world peace narrative that I think gets woven through it. And there is the want to stop evil and stop all this violence. But the solutions that they support are essentially American military intervention or international military intervention.
Right.
And there seemed to be this real disconnect between the narrative that you were seeing and even that problematic victimhood narrative and the proposed solution.
Yeah, definitely.
Which similarly was kind of ignorant of the complexity of the issue.
Yeah. Definitely. Exactly. I mean, that's probably one of the, in terms of outcomes or consequences of this of this kind of project. I think one of the big ones is just this missed opportunity for better efforts, for more sort of synergistic efforts of activists from the U.S. who really want to do something good with their lives and for people who need it, and with activists in Uganda. I think there's a huge missed opportunity. But the second consequence, which is really large, is what you were pointing to, like U.S. supporting U.S. military intervention. This has consequences, like human lives, lots of them. And
right.
And I think that does not enter the conversation at all with CONI 2012 or Invisible Children more broadly. Like, what are we supporting in terms of, you know, a history of U.S. military intervention in Africa or globally that just is not entered into the rubric of thinking here?
You've been working with this issue for quite some time now.
I first became involved in Uganda when I finished my undergraduate, which was 13 years ago in the year 2000. And I spent a year in Uganda, and sort of from that experience kind of began a long-term relationship with a couple of different communities in Uganda, and have made several trips back and have done work there and have done research there and have lived there and have also lived in the U.S. but stayed connected. So that's sort of where my relationship with Uganda and northern Uganda, my first experience in northern Uganda was in the year 2001, when the war, the LRA war, was quite vibrant in that region. And so then my interest in sort of invisible children, I first became familiar with them in 2005 when they put out their first film. I was actually invited to my alma mater, Washington University in St. Louis, to talk a little bit about northern Uganda, and they showed the Invisible Children film, and I felt a lot of dissonance in myself and what I was seeing on the screen and what I had as my own experience in the country. That was sort of the seeds for this project and for kind of exploring the issues of what does activism in northern Uganda look like, and how does that relate to these efforts of activism in the United States on behalf of northern Uganda, and now broader than that, now Central Africa, the communities that are affected by the LRA.
You talked about data and the various projects you've done in the region. So there's work that you'd be doing that's independent of this particular article on CONI 2012. Do you want to talk about your methodology, your data, and where it comes from?
Yeah, I mean, so this was my dissertation project, and I started with looking at the invisible children work in the U.S., and I spent time with invisible children in the Boston area and visited with the roadies and attended a lot of screenings and went to several student groups activities, and then I attended some of their national events. I had a fairly good sense of what was going on with invisible children at the time. This was 2009. And then I wanted to sort of juxtapose that or sort of put that into conversation with what activism in the region looked like and what it had looked like for the period of trying to address peace and human rights towards the end of the war. And so that work there in Uganda was a 9-month sort of ethnographic kind of field study, although it was building on these like 10 years prior to that of relationships. So a lot of people that I worked with were people that I had known for a while. And so I spent time with three different groups, sort of what I guess activist kind of groups. One was a peace and human rights network.
Okay.
One was a student group that was focused on health advocacy. And then the third was a collective of women that were organizing in Gulu Town. And so I looked at these three different groups and sort of trying to look at what does activism look like in this context and what are their narratives and why do people participate in this collective action? And then when I could, what do they think about these efforts of people from the West on their behalf? How do they feel about them? But what I focused on so that was ethnography and then interviews. I did interviews with 29 people. And then I did a handful of focus groups as well during that 9 months.
Focus groups is interesting. I don't hear about focus groups much anymore in sociological research, except if you're teaching a class or taking a class on sociological research. How did you find that? Was that a useful strategy for you? It must have been if you did.
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was interesting. I mean, it was with, I used, Bill Gamson is an advisor of mine, and he uses something called the peer conversations method, which is basically it's focus groups, but it's people who know each other. And the point being that people are more accountable to what they say when they're surrounded by people that know them and know where they're coming from. So I did it with some student groups. I did it with...
Yeah, it kind of seems like you have a structure to work from.
Yeah,
there, so it lends itself to the message.
Yeah, I think it did. And I used those, a couple of those are what we used. We would show three of them. We watched an Invisible Children film and then used that as sort of a prompt for the discussion. So that was okay. Very, very interesting. I think that was an interesting method.
And then the Coney 2012 piece seems to be a separate project.
Well, so the Coney 2012... Like the article that I wrote, I think
the context.
Yeah, the context piece. No, that most of that is based on this research that I had done with Invisible Children before Coney 2012. But I think it's sort of what I'm hoping to tell in the story in The White Girl's Burden is sort of the, I guess, a bit of the story of who's being mobilized with Coney 2012 and who are these Invisible Children and what have they achieved, and maybe part of why. Why were they able to do what they were able to do? Not just for that moment, but for the years leading up to it. Like, who is this group? Because I think you, as you articulated earlier, Coney 2012 happened, and it's like suddenly everyone's talking about it. But it lasted a week, and then it ended,
right.
There's a big backstory to who they were and what they. Who had been mobilized to participate in them well before March 2012.
So getting to kind of the heart of the article, you call it The White Girl's Burden. Mm-hmm. And of course, you're referencing the classic white man's burden from the period of colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
What's your explanation for why there are so many more women involved in this cause?
Yeah, it's a very interesting phenomenon. I mean, I think that women are increasingly filling the halls of higher education. And they're, you know, a lot of them are, they're more predominant in sort of social studies kind of fields. And I think, and global studies. And so I think that the humanitarian interests sort of fall along, I guess, a typical female gender construct more so than men. I think there's this sort of charitable, helping, sharing yourself kind of motif that I think really appeals to women. I sort of hint at this in the article and my research, this is something that I definitely think I would care to follow up on in future research. But I think there is an interesting dynamic as well with the leaders of the organization are these kind of hip, adventuresome men that kind of have this particularly compelling masculine construct that I think draws a lot of heterosexual women, or it's at least interesting to them. So I think that there's the way that the videos are made, at least this was working with a couple of working with one young woman in particular who was helped me as like a research assistant for once. She really commented on that dynamic that she felt that the way that the videos were made, the Invisible Children videos, the way that the young men are sort of speaking close to the camera and loving children, and that there was a dynamic of them sort of drawing more female constituents to their movement than men, in particular because of how they sort of frame themselves.
You talk about the activist as feeling uneasy with their own social advantage and then having this desire to do something, to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak more about that? Because I think that's really an interesting part of this story, an interesting part of the broader story of how activism from the U.S., from the West works now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a really interesting dynamic. It's something that I definitely can personally sort of connect with as well. I think that these young people that Invisible Children is working with are shown, in this scenario, they're shown footage from atrocities happening on the other side of the world. And I think there's a connection with, wow, this is really terrible. This, my life is, you know, somehow, there's kind of this constant comparison between like what's going on in, you know, during the LRA war and sort of what's going on in these young people's lives in the U.S. I think that's part of their choice about constantly putting in the Americans in the films. There's this kind of real stark contrast, right? And so I think people are uncomfortable with their relative privilege, and there's this desire to do something, and that's where Invisible Children, I think, from a from a mobilization perspective, I think they're quite effective in sort of channeling that energy that these people feel towards,
right.
I mean, towards fundraising and towards buying stuff, buying Invisible Children products, and towards, you know, posting things on Facebook. And then arguably they also played a big role along with the organization Resolve Uganda in real legislative lobbying and passing the LRA Disarmament and Northern Uganda Recovery Act. So I think they are effective in sort of channeling this emotional energy that people feel after they watch their films into a do something with it. So you can, you know, and I think that doing something is something that most of us want to do. I mean, being active and trying to make the world a better place is something that a lot of us want to do, especially when we reflect on our own relative privilege. So I think that they're effective in that. I think the problem is, I think, or maybe not the problem, but maybe a big concern is when it's all, when the actions are all sort of these like neat little projects that you can sort of almost check off your list, you know, go post on Facebook 10 times and buy your video and there's not this kind of space for really kind of analyzing and reflecting on the problem and on yourself and on our role as Americans in the world and on our role as Americans in the U.S. and yeah.
And you get this notion, and it's more even prevalent in popular culture these days, that if you are a privileged middle class, upper middle class, educated white person, your life and your experiences aren't as real mm-hmm. as other people's, and especially aren't as real as people who are disadvantaged in a broad spectrum of ways, who are poor, who are oppressed, who are in a situation of extreme human rights abuse, to people who are, you know, to various degrees. There's always, well, that's real and my experiences mm-hmm. aren't real. Is that something that you got from
I think there's a lot of overlap with what you're saying and what I see with Invisible Children, young people, and with young, like many of my students, and yes.
So then there's this sense that, you know, as you just put it far more articulately than I could, this sense that they need to do something about it. But then you bring up this, it hits a point, right? Where it feels good for a while doing the Facebook post and talking to your friends about it and raising money and a really astonishingly large amount of money for the cause. And this is all good work. But then you do hit that point where as you're looking for some sense of reality, and that's why you were brought to the cause, then you feel that your engagement this far isn't going anywhere, isn't providing that. So did any of your interviewees speak about what they did at that point?
Yeah, I think there were. I mean, I have to say, like, I really enjoyed the people that I interviewed with, and I feel like while I'm critical of them, and while the article is, you know, bringing up a critique of young people who are participating in something to make themselves feel good, I think at the same time, many of them are searching, and I found them asking questions,
right.
You know, of me, like especially when they found out that I had connections to Uganda with real people who are doing activism and a scholarship and other things in Uganda. They were so curious, and some of them wanted to know, well, what do they think of us? What do they think of what we're doing? I mean, I feel like there was an openness to sort of some reflection. And of course that's not everyone, but I think there was a handful of them. And I guess that in my bigger project, my dissertation project, which I'm hoping to develop into a book, I think that I argue that at the end, that while this is a moment worth critiquing, I don't think it has to just stop at critique. Like I think that there's a space here. I think there's a space here for real engagement between quote outsiders and insiders on how we can actually build more effective social change movements.
So not to put you on the spot, but can you talk more about what that looks like? You know, if someone's listening who is feeling a similar way about a cause, who is looking to get involved more, but is not looking, you know, who has had that moment of reflection and is not looking to recreate some of the problems that have existed in the past, what would be your advice to them of what to do or how to go about
it? That's a good question. Well, I think, I mean, this is based on my own experience, which is an ongoing journey that is not complete. I think I think, I mean, essentially we're talking about building partnerships. And I think that, that word partnership is kind of glamorous and it's used in a lot of global projects, right? Like we're community-based partnerships. Right. But when you really get down to like really building partnerships, there's like it's a gritty project because there's sincere inequity in the world. And so how do you build partnerships across inequity? I think a big part of it is dialogue, which involves listening for years, you know, for a long time. So I think that's an important piece. I think that the work that some of us are trying to do and which we can educate, you know, young Americans and others to sort of think about our relationship with other people in the world as peers and not necessarily like the beneficiary donor kind of relationship, but where we can be more as peers. I think that's important because if we actually think that we have colleagues, I think, or partners or classmates on the other side of the world, I think that orientation is really helpful for having that dialogue. You know what I mean? And less of this, I'm coming here to help you, but let's learn together. Another thing I think, and this is based on my own experience, is that I think for young people in the U.S. who are feeling this interest in, you know, trying to search for something more real, as you said, in their activism, I think part of it is about making a long-term commitment to a place or a group of people or to a particular issue. These are not projects that get done in a summer. You know, I think that they happen over years. I mean, that's how social movements happen as well. And I think that the most effective outsiders are those that are really willing to sort of to commit to a group that or a people or to an issue that really speaks to them. I just was thinking about something that I think, I guess like a big consequence of that, that I think is like really important and sort of is a framework to my research is that when we have that kind of Africa is primarily like victims that need Western intervention, then we really don't even look in Africa for activists or for change agents. Because we like the association then if Africa is a place of victims, primarily of victims, is that there's no one there who has any agency to do something about their situation. And then you don't even begin a conversation with people about how can we work together. I guess that's what I'm saying. I think it's a big fallout or consequence of that narrative.
And I'd imagine that would, to go back to what you just said, that would kind of hurt the notion of building these long-lasting, durable partnerships. And also hurt the notion of what I think a lot of the young people involved in Invisible Children are trying to do, which is coming to terms with their privilege, which often takes the form of not being the person who has all the answers and letting others come to you and have their own voice. And you know, that's one of the ways to minimize that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you think of Africa as a place where people have voices and ideas and are working on things themselves, it's a much more kind of complicated place to become involved, which is
right.
Which can dissuade people from participating. You know, it's nice to be the rescue guy.
One thing we haven't talked about that you talk about quite a bit in the article is the issue of faith, and that both the founders of Invisible Children and many of their followers come from that positionality of being inspired by, motivated by their own faith, typically in some form of evangelical Christianity.
I mean, it's interesting because like it wasn't ever sort of a focus of my conversations with people when I was interviewing them or when I was spending time with them in an ethnographic context, but it just, the undertones of it were strong. And so I think that they're important to pay attention to. I mean, even Jason Russell, I think I did include something that I asked him about directly related to faith. I mean, he acknowledges that faith is a huge part of his life, but he would, but they made a strategic decision to not make the organization like a faith-based organization. They wanted it to be appeal to a wider group. I think that a lot of the circles that they do, they have particularly strong affiliation towards at the university level and in the high school level are evangelical Christian groups. And that is, I believe even maybe perhaps where some of the founders and the founding staff had sort of come together in San Diego was around that involvement in those circles. So I think it's interesting. I mean, I think that the narrative that Invisible Children tries to fell or tries to put forth is just in line with a particular form of evangelical Christianity that sort of emphasizes a role of a savior that sort of divides the world into good and evil. That sort of black and white theology, I think, coalesces really well with Invisible Children's narrative. So my sense is that that's part of the reason that they are able to build on the efforts of Christian organizing so well.
Is there anything in the article that you think is important that we maybe haven't discussed yet?
Well, I do have one last thing I want to say, and I think this is something that. So this is something I struggle with because my project is definitely sort of in the participatory action research framework. And
would you mind defining that for listeners who might not be familiar?
Yeah. So participatory action research is kind of it's not just one methodology, but it's sort of like a way of a process of doing research where the goal of your research, well, your part is a couple of things. One is that the research questions and the research process is not taken alone by one sort of principal investigator, but it's often done in sort of partnership with community-based organizations. But the other piece right. is that the outcome of research is not sort of seen as just for knowledge, but it's supposed to have like an action component, a social action component. So my right. research is definitely, it was Amy Finnegan's project. I mean, it's not a PAR project completely, but I think it's infused with the principles of that, in that my goal really is to sort of contribute to consciousness raising in both the U.S. and Uganda around sort of this dynamic of insider-outsider efforts. And ultimately, my hope is that maybe some conversations are started that could lead to more synergistic efforts for social change. The other piece of PAR research is there's often a lot of self-reflection by the researchers. And so in my bigger project, a little bit in the White Girl's Burden, but a little bit in my bigger project is I sort of put myself in the research a lot, and I'm kind of reflecting on my own role and my own sort of trajectory in thinking about these questions. And I think part of the reason that's maybe interesting is because now I sort of occupy an interesting space. So I'm upper middle class white girl who I think when I look at the Invisible Children participants, I really see myself in many of them 10 years ago. And so I kind of had this connection with some of them because I sort of understand in some ways where they're coming from. But then I also have, because I've had the privilege of returning to Uganda many, many, many times, I have some, I'm certainly not an insider at all into Uganda, but I'm not as much of an outsider as I used to be. So I navigate yeah. this kind of interesting space between insider-outsider tensions. And so I think that I try to just bring that into the research and to reflect on that. And I think it was helpful to think about my own trajectory and moving from a space where my aims were maybe very similar to Invisible Children activists to maybe where they are now, which is trying to be much more critical of Western intervention by privileged white people in Africa, but also my goal here is not paralysis. And this is, I guess, what I really wanted to say is that while I have a critique, and I think it's an important critique for people for young people who are interested in Africa to think through, I think we do need to think about where we're coming from as Americans and where we're coming from as privileged white people for those of us that applies to. But I also think that there is, it doesn't mean that you need to just, not do anything about the world. I think it's about being thoughtful. I think, and I, like I said before, I think it's a lot about trying to build real partnerships with people. And I think it's possible, but it does take a long time, and it's going to take some critical reflective analysis, and it's going to take some creativity. But it's possible. And I think that, my goal here is that we critique what we've done, but that we can do it better, and not that we just be like, oh, well, hands up, let's just stay home. It's not even worth it. And that's one critique. Like when I've talked to Invisible Children people and they hear what I have to say or what others have to say, well, their line will be something like, well, at least we're doing something, you know, what are you doing? And I think that they have a point in some ways, that there is an effort that they some people really tried hard in what they put together. And I think it falls short in many ways. And so it deserves critique and an analysis, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't do anything. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. And that did motivate some of the ways I asked the questions, because I think that beyond the specifics of the case, that's a lesson, and a really important lesson for people interested in public sociology and public sociologies to take to heart, is that so much of our work, you know, the critique part of it is the part that gets blown up. It's the part that people talk about. But I really appreciate your phrasing. It shouldn't turn into paralysis, that this should lead to better ways of doing this that have better outcomes for all parties involved. And I think that's where a lot of new voices should be heard.
I think that after, like, in the wake of Kony 2012, like, I think a lot of us felt really good about watching that video and then, like, posting our blog about, like, how terrible it was and, you know, like, how, like, short-sighted and naive these young people were. I just want to be reflective of that space, too, there's something good about being reflective and critical of people. And let's not stop there.
Amy Finnegan, thank you so much for discussing your article with us today.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
I'm glad you did. That's Amy Finnegan. She's the author of The White Girl's Burden, a feature article in the winter 2013 issue of Context, available now. Find out more at context.org. This is